Welcome to Echolocation on WGXC 90.7 FM and wavefarm.org. I'm your hostess, Elizabeth Lojudis, and this summertime broadcast theme is a soniferous aquatic cacophony, a mixture of sounds from both above and below the water's surface. We heard fish, including a species called the midshipman, and another that's called the oyster toadfish, and we also heard the spouting of an Amazon river dolphin and the voice of the water itself in the form of a babbling brook. The Earth is a watery planet, and summer is the watery season, so on today's show, we're going to spend some time by rivers, both far away and nearby. We'll be traveling to the Amazon River to learn about a really unusual echolocator, the electric eel. We'll also stay closer to home to investigate the American eel, our Hudson River native species, that doesn't emit electric pulses, but is amazing and unique in other ways. Then we'll stick our ears below the surface to hear the news from the underworld. And we'll travel through both space and time to explore the entire length of a river by listening to Anaya Lockwood's Sound Map of the Hudson River, which was recorded way back in 1982. Some scientists contend that being near water is good for your cognitive, emotional, psychological, spiritual, social, and physical well-being. Marine biologist Wallace Nichols, author of the New York Times bestseller Blue Mind, maintains that being on, near, or underwater, or even listening to watery sounds, can induce a meditative state and lead to greater serenity and creativity. Plus, being near water is just plain fun, so we're going to beat the summertime heat by hanging out by the river.
I'll meet you down by the river, down by the river, down by the river, to see what we can see, down by the river, by the Hudson River, down by the river, that's where I want to be. You may be feeling cramped and crowded. You may be feeling restless and bored. I know a place can cure what ails you. Leave you refreshed, leave your mind restored. I'll meet you down by the river, down by the river, down by the river, to see what we can see. Down by the river, down by the Hudson River, down by the river, that's where I want to be. You never know what you might find there. You never know what the tide will bring. But I know you'll find peace of mind there. Something about it makes me want to sing. I'll meet you down by the river, down by the river, down by the river, to see what we can see. Down by the river, down by the Hudson River, down by the river, that's where I want to be. Just make your way down to the water. That river will bring the world to your feet. Might be something washed down from the mountains, or drenched right out from the ocean deep. I'll meet you down by the river, down by the river, down by the river, to see what we can see. Down by the river, by the Hudson River, down by the river, that's where I want to be. Once we got careless about our river, let it fill up with pollution and trash. Now we're trying hard.
sure that our river will last.
I'll meet you down by the river, down by the river, down by the river, to see what we can see. Down by the river, oh, by the Hudson River, down by the river, that's where I want to be.
I'll meet you down by the river, down by the river, down by the river, to see what we can see. Down by the river, oh, by the Hudson River, down by the river, that's where I want to be.
Mm-hmm.
Down by the river, that's where I want to be.
You bet.
Down by the river, that's where I want to be.
Down by the river, that's where I want to be.
Yes. That was Down by the River by Betty and the Baby Boomers, a homegrown Hudson Valley band. If you like that song, you can check out their website at bettyandthebabyboomers.com. This broadcast's echolocator profile takes us to a faraway river, the mighty Amazon.
Well, it's that time again. It's time for the echolocator profile.
Today's echolocator profile is a different sort of creature. It's not a mammal or a bird, it's a fish. And not just any fish, but an electric eel, which doesn't use sonar, but actually employs electrical pulses to navigate and locate prey. Electric eels live in the waters of the Amazon River Basin in South America. Despite their snake-like appearance, they are not actually eels, but are members of a group of electrical fish that include the knife fish and the ghost fish. They're more closely related to catfish than true eels. Electric eels live and hunt in the oftentimes murky waters of the Amazon, and they are nocturnal, so relying on their poor vision to navigate and locate their prey is not very efficient. So, electric eels use weak electrical signals to help in navigation and social communication with others of their species. The fish use electrical pulses to read their environment in a way that is similar to echolocation. Some of the electrical receptors are tuned to the transmission of non-electric fish and can even detect heartbeats. The electric eel is mostly tail. Its organs are bunched up near its head, and its long tail is capable of producing electricity. They can grow to be very large, up to 8 feet in length. So their tails are capable of generating an electrical charge up to 600 volts. It's well known that electric eels employ their high voltage power to defend themselves and stun their prey. But just a few years ago, scientists from Vanderbilt University discovered that electric eels also use this energy to locate their stunned prey. Neurobiologist Ken Canatia studied electric eels in the laboratory using high-speed video to record their hunting behaviors. He found that the fish use electrical pulses to simultaneously stun their prey and to find it in the dark and gobble it up. The ability of these fish to use electrical pulses to navigate has been dubbed electrolocation. Ken Cantania hypothesizes that the electric eel's high voltage charge first evolved as a means of navigating in the dark. The use of this superpower to hunt prey came later, and now the fish packs a 1-2 punch, locating and stunning its prey with the power of electricity. So that's our echolocator profile for this broadcast. The electric eel, that large, slimy, long-tailed, high-voltage, electro-locating fish of the Amazon. And now, the electric eels.
Oh, I'm so agitated, so agitated. Run through a washer machine, agitated. I'm so agitated, I'm so convoluted. I don't know what I know, but I just like to shoot it. And it's 5 a.m. and I'm crawling the walls, just waiting for imaginary telephone calls. And I'm so agitated, so agitated, agitated. I'm so agitated, I'm so agitated, I'm so agitated that I'm so agitated. You know what I think? I think the whole world stinks, and I don't need no shrink. I just hate it. I'm so convoluted, I'm so convoluted that I'm so agitated. And sometimes I think I'd be better off dead, just like my cousin Fred.
The eel is a kind of a cool little critter.
But the eel gets no respect.
A fish, how do you know it's a fish?
Yeah, he's got fins and he's also got gills.
So this is a fish, it's not a snake, it's not a reptile. Where eels are born.
Sargasso Sea.
Yes, exactly. They're born in Sargasso Sea, which is in between Bermuda and Puerto Rico. So they travel 1,000 miles to get up here to the Hudson. And then they'll stay here. The males will stay for, 7-10 years. The females a little bit longer, up to 30 years max. And then where do they go? Yes.
Back to the Sargasso Sea.
Back to the Sargasso Sea, exactly. And then they'll spawn once, and then they'll die. That's their life cycle.
Yeah, eels have been around for a long time since eels have been around for since dinosaurs.
Wow.
People eat the eels.
Yeah, they eat eels.
If there was no more eels, I wouldn't like that.
You're listening to Echolocation on WGXC 90.7 FM and wavefarm.org. We just heard Agitated by the Electric Eels, recorded in 1975, followed by a composition that I call Eel Respect, about the American eel, a migratory fish that is native to the Hudson River and the Sargasso Sea off the coast of Bermuda. Artist Sam Sebrin and I collaborated on an hour-long program about the American eel a few years back, which aired on WGXC on Sam's show, The Nothing Is Real Radio Hour. You can hear that show by searching the WGXC archives for the Everything Is Eel show. Be sure to keep tuning in to listen to the latest edition of the Nothing Is Real Radio Hour at 2 p.m. today. I call our next segment News from the Sounding Board, which features updates from the world of bioacoustics, soundscape studies, and environmental sound research. And today, we'll be accompanied by Handel's Water Music. The article, Why the Sound of Water Helps You Sleep, by Cheyenne MacDonald, was published in the UK's DailyMail.com. The article explains that sounds, such as the ocean, raindrops, and the rumble of a distant thunderstorm, are interpreted as non-threatening by the human brain. The article describes a study conducted at Penn State that investigated the effects of threatening versus non-threatening sounds on sleep, and suggests that non-threatening water sounds can be used to block out alarming sounds such as those in a hospital to allow a good night's sleep. Now we have a story about fornicating fish. A study recently published in the journal Scientific Reports describes a method for using the sound of spawning fish to pinpoint the location of schools in the Gulf of Mexico in an effort to protect them. The calls of male fish of a variety of species, including the Gulf corvin, the cod, groupers, and croakers, can be used to alert scientists of the presence of schools of these fish as they are collecting to reproduce. And pinpointing the location of spawning fish can help to regulate fishing and protect the spawning schools from exploitative fishing practices. In another ocean-related sound story, an article by Dr. Harold Rosenbaum of the Wildlife Conservation Society on the National Geographic Society website on June 8th informs readers of the proceedings of the UN Ocean Conference in New York City. Pollution, including ocean noise pollution, was a topic of discussion at the conference. As we've discussed on other broadcasts of this show, ocean noise pollution from ships, sonar, and energy exploration have an impact on marine species from fish to whales, and even smaller creatures. This issue is especially pressing as an executive order was signed that negates a 5-year ban on gas and oil exploration along the U.S. East Coast. Seismic airgun surveys pose a great risk for the world's most endangered large mammal species, the right whales, and scientists from a consortium of universities, agencies, and organizations are calling for a reinstatement of the ban. For more information on this and the other stories in News for the Sounding Board, go to the Echolocation Facebook page and references will be listed. We're going to spend the rest of today's show listening to a composition by Anaya Lockwood entitled A Sound Map of the Hudson River. Anaya Lockwood is a composer who is from New Zealand, but has spent a lot of time in the Hudson Valley and has a strong connection to American composers such as Pauline Oliveros and John Cage. Lockwood is an emerita professor at Vassar College, and she has recorded what she calls sound maps of rivers around the world, including New York's Hudson River. Lockwood recorded the sound map of the Hudson River in 1982, and the composition was re-released in 2003 and incorporated into the Hudson River Museum's permanent Riverama exhibit. So we're going to listen to the sound map of the Hudson River, which starts in the tributary streams that are the source of the river, way up in the Adirondack Mountains, and follows the river all the way to its mouth at New York Harbor. As part of her sound map project, Lockwood also recorded interviews with river enthusiasts along the Hudson. The interviews were not released commercially, but luckily a copy is housed at the library at the Wave Farm Study Center, so I have interspersed excerpts from the interviews with the sound map tracks. So I hope you enjoy.
dawn, we'd gotten into the town of North River after driving all night from the Bronx, and we stopped at the corner. There was a gas station, and the river made a 90-degree turn. Here was a huge river, 200-400 yards wide. It was completely clear, not limpid clear like a chalk stream in England, but clear, and I guess you could call it a typical Adirondack-type water, a tannin-colored water that was a yellowish-brown, but nonetheless clear. The Hudson, in all the years that I've known it, at any rate, I've never known it to color. By that I mean pick up mud or silt at that geographical location of the river. Possibly further downstream it does, but apparently from Newcomb, Harris Lake, which is the section I'm familiar with, on down through North River, North Creek, maybe as far as Riparius, the river runs through a second growth forest that is so spongy that it doesn't allow any runoff to get into the river. The river comes up. It'll come up 1 inch, 2 inches, 3 inches, maybe even more than that after a heavy rain, but it never colors. So anyway, there were 4 or 5 or 6 guys just out of World War II standing on a riverbank looking at this. Just absolutely overawed. The largest river that any of us had seen up to that point, I guess, would have been the Beaverkill in the Catskills, which is hardly a mud puddle compared to what the Hudson is, although probably somebody who was a disciple of Theodore Gordon would have my hair for saying something like that, but the Beaverkill is not a big stream by any stretch of anyone's imagination. I would love to say that we destroyed the big trout that first trip. We didn't. We caught an awful lot of smallmouth bass, mainly because we were, I think, overawed completely by the river. It just overawed us.
think the only time we have high water is, unless you get an especially bad flood or rain, is in the spring of the year and the runoff from the snow. We've had very high waters here. Remember that the rivers occasionally get to, of course, the river freezes over in the winter completely. In the summer, in the spring, early in spring, when the water begins to warm up and the weather begins to warm up, then the ice melts and the water rises from the snow runoff in the mountains, and they get what they call ice jams. The ice will come to a narrow part in the river and jam up and have jams back maybe a mile, 2 miles or so forth. And consequently, it floods the area back of the jams. And we've had occasions where that has happened, but enough. I don't think any great consequences, serious consequences from it. Well, there's no communities that are low-lying enough so they've been affected by high water. This town, of course, is out of the way. It's high enough so that the river doesn't bother. North River has been flooded back many years ago, I recall. Ice jamming up in that narrow spot, you might recall, where if you was up there at the races, this is a narrow spot where it's very rough water. The ice used to jam up in that spot, back up by that village. And I've seen the water up around most of those houses on that, in that area, what they call North River. But I didn't live there, so I never had any occasion to experience that situation. But I lived as a child just a short distance from there. So I recall seeing the ice jamming up and blocking the road in that area, but never anything of any serious consequence. But of course, when this ice breaks up, you get ice in probably 30, 40, maybe 50 feet long and 30, 40 feet wide, you know, big chunks, until it breaks up in small pieces way. But there's occasionally large pieces in these jams. You can hear them for, great distance. And years ago when they had the logs in the river and they get log jams, and when the logs break up, well, of course, then you hear them tumbling down with the ice. Well, we didn't think of anything about the seriousness of it or doing any damage. Nothing that ever bothered them too much or they weren't affected by it.
Thank you. This river up here in the springs is an entirely different animal than what you saw yesterday. It would probably be 20 feet above what you saw it yesterday, at least. In a normal year with a normal snowfall in the mountain. In a heavier year, it would be more than that. And the river would be absolutely white. All down to there, there wouldn't be one stretch of water, but was absolutely white. And there's boulders in there, you know, as big as these rooms. All up and down through that thing there. And every year when you get high water, it changes them too. It'll bring stuff in and take stuff out, so the pools are changing all the time. They're never the same from one year to next, because those boulders will move. You see the thrust of that water there, it'll... So it changes things. You go fishing, you notice it when you're fishing. You wade out into a place, there used to be a rock there, the trout under it. Well, the rock's gone now. Yeah, there's maybe another one there now, bigger or smaller or something like that. It's every bit is the speed and the, not necessarily the volume, but the currents and everything, they're just as bad as they are out on the Colorado, the Snake, or any of those huge rivers. This near just as bad as far as the white water is, people are concerned. The canoeists, the kayakists, and all that do all this traveling around the world on these rivers, this is one of the worst that there is for when it's up. It doesn't hold second fiddle to anybody. That's quite a river.
Thanks for listening to the first hour of the summer's 2017 broadcast of Echolocation on WGXC 90.7 FM and wavefarm.org. I'm your hostess, Elizabeth Lo Judas, and I'd like to thank the following contributors to this show. The Macaulay Library at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology provided the sounds of Midshipman Fish, recorded by A.H. Bass, of oyster toadfish, recorded by P.J. Perkins, and of the Amazon River dolphin, recorded by Theodore Parker III. I'd like to thank Galen Joseph Hunter at the Wave Farm for providing the sound map of the Hudson River interviews. We heard music by Betty and the Baby Boomers, the Electric Eels, and George Frederick Handel. We've been listening to a sound map of the Hudson River by Anaya Lockwood, and we'll continue hearing the compositions in the second hour of the show, so please stay tuned. We'll also explore an important Hudson Valley happening called the Water Walk for Life. Buddhist nun June Yasuda of the Grafton Peace Pagoda is currently leading a peace walk to raise awareness of the Pilgrim Pipelines, a dual pipeline that is currently proposed to run along the west side of the Hudson River from Albany to New Jersey, crossing many waterways. June Yasuda and others are walking the entire 130-mile length of the pipeline, and you can join them for a mile, a day's walk, or for the rest of their journey. They will be in Greene County over the coming days, and you can meet the walkers at a potluck supper on Sunday, June 30th, at the Rivertide Aikido Center in Catskill at 5 p.m. I'll share more of their itinerary coming up in the next hour, but if you'd like to learn more, visit graftonpeacepagoda.org. And always, for a complete list of references and more information, visit our Facebook page at echolocation/WGXC.